This is episode 45 of The Fifth Estate. Ben Domenech, founder and publisher of The Federalist.
Folks, Neil Doing here to tell you about our friends at Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house, has a sleek design, and is delivered in a small how-did-they-do-that-size box. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. Its supportive memory foam offers a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. With over 20,000 reviews and over 4.8 out of 5 stars, it is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns to the US and Canada with a 100-night home trial. That's 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Now, a special offer for our listeners. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/fifth and using fifth as your promo code. That's www.casper.com/fifth, promo code fifth.
All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
Fine as a frog hair split four ways there, Jay.
All right.
Fixing to get finer.
Nice. What are you drinking tonight? Drinking anything good?
I'm drinking Bullet Bourbon. The first of many drinks I shall consume over the next 3 days as I am headed on a vacation to Charleston,
oh, okay.
South Carolina.
The liquid vacation.
Yes, I intend not to remember it.
That's always a good thing. That's always a good thing.
It depends on who you ask.
Yeah, well.
My sponsor doesn't agree.
Speaking of stuff that is fun, you know, what's fun for us is when we see reviews of this podcast and star ratings of this podcast on iTunes. That's a lot of fun.
Oh, 100% fun.
Yeah.
I actually kind of live for 5-star reviews now. It's the only thing that gives me any comfort.
Yeah, I know. And it's like the last one we got was from somebody who said they were left of center and said they're glad that we weren't like all these other crazy right wingers.
Hey. As far as they know, we're not.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But speaking of far right wingers, no. But it was funny, and we'll chat with our guest about this, about the review. It was kind of funny because we'll read it because I think he'd find it funny. The Federalist is a website just for, and also, you know, here for full disclosure, Neil and I have both written for that publication. So, but, you know, we will remain steadfast in our principles not to just, you know, go lightly here, correct?
Oh, no, I fully intend to make this a puff piece.
Well, now that Neil's given it away, he's had too much of that bourbon.
Integrity? What's that?
Yes.
Here's the thing. Jay, when you and I first got together, we were writing for Pocketful of Liberty, mm-hmm. and that was fun. Starting this website, putting it out there, making it work. And a few months into that, Ben Domenech comes to me and he sends me an email and he says, hey, I'd like you to write for this new site I'm starting. It's called The Federalist. And I want you to write about booze. And I was like, me? Booze? But I said yes, and I accepted the challenge, and I've never been the same. Never been the same, Ben. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, but no,
I've heard the chimes at midnight, Neil.
So you know, one of the things I think a lot of people wonder about, one of the things that I certainly wonder about, is you know what goes into making a website. You know, we know a little bit about the work that goes into it. What goes into making this website that really hits it big, has a lot of influence, attracts a lot of top talent. And so, yeah, we thought who better to bring on than our friend Ben Domenech, the publisher of The Federalist. So at long last, hello, Ben.
Good to be with you both.
Yeah.
And I hope that you will not hold back on questioning simply because I have given you booze money in exchange for words, which is of course the foundation of all journalism.
It pretty much is.
It is, exactly. The whole point of journalism is to be able to have a job where you wine and dine other people to get them to tell you things. And you write about those things and you get paid in order to go and then wine and dine yourself and your friend. And that's really, you know, that's just that's the circle of media. It's the way it works. So, I appreciate, of course, the kind words. But in answer to your question, Neil, what it takes to start something like this up is a certain degree of madness. I mean, the fact is that whenever you're starting a publication of any kind, whether it's a magazine or an academic journal or a group blog or a web publication. And I have started all of those and I have failed at most of those and succeeded at basically three. And what you come down to is it's actually about people and being able to find the right people who fit into the mix, to cultivate their talents, to make sure that they're feeling like they are appreciated and that they are getting the best out of themselves in that role, and then building on that. And honestly, that's really the core answer to this, which is that if you have the ability to work with a lot of writers, many of whom are, you know, sensitive souls for whom every word is valuable, and some of whom don't need any cultivation at all, you have to get the right mix of good cops and bad cops, people who are snarky, people who are funny, people who are softer and will use a gentle touch. And if you combine those different things together, then you can get a great publication. And that's what we strive to be.
Fascinating. So we'll expand on, I think, each of those points that you touched on as we go through. But I want to take it back to the very beginning, Ben, which I am told is a very good place to start. Tell us sort of the origin story of The Federalist. What was the germ of this idea, and how did it sort of spring forth?
So it actually sprang forth because of something that I wanted other people to do, and they didn't do it. So I had, just to give a bit of background, I had co-founded Red State back in the day. We had sold it to Eagle Publishing, which really didn't do what we hoped they would do with it in terms of building it into something that was kind of a bigger tent site. It kind of rose up as being more of a Tea Party publication and that kind of thing. And that's fine. You know, there's places for that. But I had always had in mind this, you know, basically a center-right publication that would be smart and funny and entertaining and have a good sense of humor and talk about culture and sex and all sorts of other things that I think are a lot more important than politics. And I got tired of reading all these publications that were center right, but then just primarily devoted themselves to politics and policy and these practical, dry subjects. When I think, you know, as Andrew Breitbart thought, that, you know, politics is downstream from culture. And the real way that this actually coalesced in my head is I thought for years about this as being kind of an intellectual publication that would be the kind of place that basically if you gave Ross Douthat, you know, $2 million a year to run a publication, that this is what you would create. But here's actually where the light switch went off. It actually went off because of what the left was doing. You saw these publications in the last several years of all these different manifestos, these from various kind of post-feminists trying to wrestle with the reality that they were inhabiting. And you read about leaning in and having it all and tiger moms, and you read about all these different controversies that were happening among working and middle and upper class women, very smart women. And what really caught hold for me was this realization that, you know, there isn't a publication for smart women on the right. There isn't a publication that is addressed to the cultural tempo, the interests, or the various proclivities of college educated women who, you know, frankly, make up a significant portion of the center right. I mean, obviously, college educated women, white women, voted for Trump. And it's one of these things where it's, you know, there's an audience there that is not necessarily interested in the lockstep genital focused politics of Girls and of Vogue and of Cosmopolitan. And yet there was no real audience for them. What are they supposed to be reading? Where are they supposed to be reading about their culture? Where are they supposed to be reading about the issues related to education and child rearing and fashion and pop culture and all of the different things that are very entertaining and fine and wonderful, but also are basically shoved in the back of the book in a lot of the legacy magazines of the right, because those magazines were overwhelmingly published for old white men. And so what that really did was it changed the focus, where before I was thinking about this as just, you know, culture in a sense, to one that was more going to be about engaging in the cultural interests of not just the center right, but of center right women in particular. And that's why we are, from to my knowledge, the only political publication, the only major political publication in America today that has a majority female staff. That has, you know, a huge number of female contributors, and that has an audience that tends to be a lot more female than what you typically see from political publications, but also politically center right publications. And so what that really did, that germ of an idea about we need something that more engages directly in culture, turned into, wait a minute, it's not just about culture, it's about women who are in these positions. And I will tell you, Neil, and it will not surprise you to know that that this is an audience that is also very advertiser friendly. They're making a lot of decisions about purchases in the home. They tend to be people who, you know, make a lot of decisions related to that. And so that became more of a business proposition, and one that we could sell to people who were interested in backing something that would be a voice on these subjects that would separate itself from kind of the dry older media that, you know, frankly accomplished a lot for the conservative movement and for center-right people generally in the conversation in America, but also was kind of built to battle a left of a different time and of a different character than the one that we currently see today.
Yeah, you know, Ben, that is an interesting point, and I agree. I think there aren't really any other spaces out there that have that focus on their audience. And, you know, I first became aware of this, you know, I was writing for you guys from the beginning, and I noticed that all the complaints about the offensive things that I said were predominantly coming from women. And I was like, am I not offending any men with my writing? But no, it just turns out that was the demographic we were chasing. So, so when you're putting all this sort of stuff together, you know, is there a playbook for launching a media outlet like this? Like, how much of this did you and your partners and you know, your co-founders how much of this did you have to figure out on your own? Were you able to draw from previous experience, or is there a playbook that conservative media passed around to say, okay, this is what you do?
So if there is a playbook, I don't have access to it.
Okay.
I have to admit that in the context of this discussion, I have never been, you know, I had this as a germ of the idea. I was a fellow for a Chicago-based think tank, the Heartland Institute, and I had started up my own little newsletter, email newsletter, subscription newsletter, The Transom, which continues.
Fabulous, by the way.
Thank you.
And, subscribe, everybody.
I appreciate that. Thetransom.com. And basically what I had in mind was something that was pretty sketchy because I had not gone through the various training programs that now exist for many young people on the center right. I had not been through any of these writing fellowships or won any of these various awards or anything like that that gives you that kind of training. And so for me, I actually, believe it or not, I went back to a profile, basically an extended bio of Henry Luce, the founder of Time magazine. And it might surprise you to know this, but Time is really the original aggregator. It was designed to aggregate the news from all across the world for middle class Americans and to, you know, put these various things in front of them. And Henry Luce had this sort of prescriptive list of prejudices, as he called them. And it's very interesting to go back and read them, and you can find them online. And in fact, I included them in the first post that we ever put up at the Federalist, where it talked about kind of the various prejudices that he believed Time magazine ought to exemplify. And one of them was an appreciation for the new, particularly in ideas, an appreciation for the old, particularly in manners, an appreciation for the statesman's view of the world, that we shouldn't just have a view only based on the nation, but that we should be more expansive. And it goes on to include things like, you know, an appreciation for religious faith, you know, an appreciation for all these different things that we would view as being at the center of American life, and an appreciation for economy, particularly in government, in the sense that, you know, a limited government was something that we ought to aspire for as Americans. And what I think you understand if you look at something like that is that at the time he was speaking to the center of America, he was speaking to the nation, you know, as it was then. Now we have a nation that is very different. And so I didn't have any real playbook to go by, but Time magazine started basically as the idea of two friends. And in the case of the Federalist, it really started as something that was a combination of my own beliefs and you cut out there for a second. You there?
Yeah, we're good.
Yep, we hear you.
Okay. Sorry. It started essentially as a combination of my own beliefs and the beliefs of Sean Davis, who is, you know, still my co-founder and CFO. He had been the CFO of the Daily Caller when it started up. And from the get-go, we knew that there were two people we wanted right off the bat. Molly Hemingway, who I felt was an extremely underappreciated talent, who had been blogging at various sites for a while, and David Harsanyi, who I also felt was very underappreciated, both of whom are people with mainstream media cred, who have a background, working alongside, major reporters, you know, Harsanyi for years at the Denver Post, and Sean Davis, who had been a chief in a previous lifetime, a chief investigator for Tom Coburn on the U.S. Senate, and because of that had the kind of investigative chops and, the eye for sort of cutting through the BS that I wanted to have on staff. We grew from there to the point that we are at now, where we have Joy Pullman, we have Gracie Olmsted, we have John Davidson, we have Rob Trzynski, we have Bree Payton, we have Madeline Orr, and we have Mary Catherine Hamm. We feel like this is a team that is very solid, that is hardworking, that is dedicated to putting out high quality content, and they have their own various focuses and intelligence, and I think that team, just building that team, was really the approach that I adopted. If there was a playbook, it was really just about find the right people who are going to be hardworking, not complain a lot, and are always going to be cracking a joke along the way.
So when you're looking into doing something like this, so you have identified the people that you wanted to be a part of it, how do you convince them to go along? I mean, you know, it's like if you're asking them to be, just correct me if I'm wrong, like the core people that you mentioned were hired.
Yeah.
Is that right? Or was it, hey, we're going to try this, and if it works out, but I'm guessing, you know, both of them from what I know, they have families, they need income. Yeah. So what was your approach to them to say, hey, you know, drop what you're doing, for the most part, and come and join me on this thing. Like,
I got to be honest, it was a roll of the dice, you know, in the sense that, you know, they very much knew going in that, I mean, there weren't contracts for people, you know. Sean and I essentially cut back our work to extremely part-time, let's put it that way, in order to do this. And there was always that risk that it could fail.
Sure.
We tried to keep things very cheap when we were starting out. And, you know, we went virtual and we were just, you know, everybody's going to work from home. Everybody has to do everything. We're all going to pitch in and handle stuff. And it's, you know, I mean, one of the things that I think is true about us is that we, whenever you have a startup mentality, nobody's too big to do anything. That means, you know, I was in there changing out pictures and, you know, fixing tags and editing content and that type of thing, you know, early on, you know, at a point where we needed that done. And that was something that, you know, was going to be a challenge, and we knew it was going to be a challenge. But then after we had been doing it for a while, we got to a point where we could grow and had income flow from advertising and everything else that comes with that and traffic. And frankly, we had the good fortune of, you know, having a number of very sharp, well-written contributors who came and gave us some great material that really went and helped us establish the kind of brand that we wanted to establish. So, I mean, it's a lot easier to get people to jump to things like that if you have some general backstop to what you're doing. You know, in other words, if you're one of these places that buys a building before you buy a staff, it's a lot easier to convince people to join in.
Right.
But we were the other way around. We were small bore from day one, and we really grew into, you know, what we've become now without really engaging in the kind of big impressive expenditures that a lot of other places have done, you know, when they've rented out floors in prominent buildings and stuff like that.
So when looking, maybe we're jumping ahead a little bit here, but in looking at some of the material and what you're looking for, so you knew what you were looking for and people you wanted to join the team, mm-hmm. but what is it about, you know, so like the contributors, I mean, if you go, and anybody who wants to go to, if you go to federalist.com and click on contributors, the list is ridiculously long, which is great because there's that many people that have written for you. You know, I'm assuming with people sending in ideas constantly, if somebody let's do this for somebody who may be listening, if they wanted to contribute to the Federalist, what are you looking for? What is, because there's a variety of subjects, but, and I kind of know the answer to this question, I'm still going to ask you anyway, is how does a person sit there and say, I want to look at something and I'm going to differentiate it from what is typically going to be written about this particular subject?
Yeah. So we get pitches all the time on all sorts of different stories. And one of the things that I really, you know, value is having a cultural hook to whatever you're talking about. So, you know, in this context, I'm interested in, you know, hooks that relate to, you know, the changing nature of American masculinity, but through the vision of film. Okay. So you look at particular characters that were in the most recent Fast and Furious movie and analyze, you know, what's different about them from older movie stars or something along those lines. Like that's an interesting topic. Now, of course, you still have to execute it. You'd have to, you know, write something that was funny and entertaining and interesting. You know, one of the things that I've actually noticed is that we really like to approach these cultural issues by saying, what's the counterintuitive lesson that people might be taking away from this? We try to do more than just scold. I feel like too many center-right places scold the culture and feel like it's irredeemable and there's nothing that's good to be found there. We're a lot more interested in finding the good and basically saying, you know, there's different aspects of these cultural notes that are interesting to lots of people and watched by lots of people and written about by even more that would be worthwhile to study and to look at as being something that's interesting and perhaps has a lesson that's counterintuitive to it. Now, whether you're going to be able to make a case to me that the most recent reboot of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, you know, in some way, you know, tells us something about humanity's value, something like that. I mean, that would be pretty impressive if you could pull that off. In fact, you know, hey, maybe that's a dare to your listeners. But you know, I joked a couple days ago, or I guess April 1st. I joked when they had the Rick and Morty premiere, this animated show, which I think is hilarious and basically the best show on TV today. They at the end of the show, the way that one of the main characters, spoiler alert, though it's been out for a number of weeks now, the way that they ruin someone's economy is essentially by devaluing their currency via a centralized banking system. And I joked on Twitter that I was very disappointed that no one had pitched me on why this is a lesson on why we need to audit the Fed. But I'm only slightly joking there. Like, that's actually a good hook for saying, well, wait, what does this tell us about the way we think about currency and money and the way, and, you know, should it be tied to a neutral standard? Should it be something that can be changed with the flip of a switch at a computer? You know, that kind of thing. And so it's just, I'm always looking for cultural hooks for things that are political that people may not necessarily think are political. A perfect example of this, I think, is sports radio. Sports radio is constantly venturing into politics. It's everywhere. It's not just, you know, the way that stadiums are paid for. It's the way that NCAA athletes are treated. It's the way that women are treated in sports. It's the way that we have interaction between, you know, on various racial bases. You know, somehow the other day, Stephen A. Smith turned Tony Romo playing a sort of a joke matchup thing for the Mavs into some commentary on race in America. All these things are political, but what people don't necessarily see them as such because they are viewing them through the lens of whatever they're looking at. I want to draw out the interesting lessons we can take from those and basically use it to explain what's going on, to offer an interesting opinion and analysis particularly from those who have an interesting story to tell in their own right.
Doesn't that presume a base level of intelligence and humor from the denizens of the internet, though, Ben?
Well, yes, Neil. Yes, it does.
apparently more faith in humanity than I do.
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's necessarily faith. I mean, we don't write trollish pieces every day, but when we do, we try to make them funny. The other day, Daniel Payne, who was without question the most trollish, I think, of any of our writers, considering that he believes that Episode 3 is the greatest Star Wars movie and insists on this.
Yeah.
He wrote a piece responding to that hoax, Huffington Post piece. The fact that it was a hoax, making it no less true, which was making the argument that white men should be denied the voting franchise. And Daniel's main pitch to us was that actually, if you believe in the power of patriarchy, denying white men the franchise wouldn't succeed because they would simply compel their various wives to vote for them in their stead. And that this would be denying the franchise to not just one, but two people every time you did it. Now, this was sufficiently trollish that it aroused the frustrations of quite a number of people. But more often, what we're trying to do, I would say, is it's not so much to puncture or to snark, but rather to find something that's redeemable. There were a lot of people who were disappointed in the end of Lena Dunham's Girls series, in part because she decided to keep the baby that she was having had and was carrying, and despite, you know, having all sorts of reasons to abort it, and despite Lena Dunham saying that she wished the character would have an abortion, and we found that to be something that was, you know, not just good but worth applauding, and basically saying, you know, even by accident, the lesson that you actually took away from this is that there's another human in the picture, and that we can't ignore that. And I'm sure that it was not Lena Dunham's intent. It may have been Judd Apatow's, but it was something that lent itself to a story that could have a lot more for people who are center right to appreciate.
Hmm. It sort of leads me into my next question for you, Ben, which is about your role as the publisher of The Federalist. Now, how does that differ from what an editor would do, or an editor in chief, for instance? You know, you said that because you guys have a startup mentality, everybody, you know, no job is too small for somebody on the staff there. So, but I assume that, you know, everybody has their main focus. So do you focus on like strategy and growth more than, say, specific content decisions, or are you still heavily involved in those kind of things? Yeah.
So it's a mix. I didn't, when we started out, I could have taken an editor in chief title, but and we don't have an editor in chief. The reason that I didn't is just that I don't edit things. That's the one thing I don't do now. I mean, I did a little bit at the beginning, but basically my focus is more on both growing the business and interfacing with everybody that we have to because of that. But also, you know, when it comes time to make decisions about content, more often than not, I would say that I'm weighing in and giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down on things. I probably kill more things than some of the other folks, just because I, you know, tend to be a little bit more a stickler, I would say. But I would say we all kill things. You know, the senior editors, Molly and David, and then Sean really weigh in on most things, and Joy weighs in on, our managing editor, weighs in on everything. And, you know, typically I would say that I'm in agreement with Joy on things. It's rare where I'm saying, you know, no to something that she's approving of, or vice versa. But you know, when it comes to approving content, I still play a role, but on the actual hands-on editing or preparation of articles or something like that, it's just not something I have the time or bandwidth for anymore.
Interesting. Well, you know, one of the things that I've been very impressed with is the way you've developed, you know, members of your staff and also even contributors into getting media roles, increasing the media presence of both themselves and the Federalists. Is that something that you've actively worked on? Do you have partners that have assisted with that? Are how does that happen?
Well, we worked early on with some folks in PR to kind of get people placed before people knew who we were. But we stopped that a little less, I would say, than a year ago, and really have just now gotten into a rhythm where people get opportunities that walk in the door. You know, it's always a bit of a learning curve. You know, Molly Hemingway just got a Fox News contract, and I'm very happy and proud of her. She had done almost no TV before we hired her. And in fact, she quite resented me for a while there, because she had never been one to wear makeup, being a little bit of a Western hippie herself and her mentality when it came to that kind of thing. And so unfortunately, she had to wear a lot of makeup when you go on Fox. And so that's the sort of thing that it takes a long time to build up. I mean, I'm on contract now at CBS News. We have Mary Catherine at CNN, and then we have Bree Payton really kind of punching away and doing a lot of work on Fox these days. So she's next up in terms of trying to push for something. And then we also have, you know, people who, senior contributors who very regularly do NPR, do a lot of the different streaming networks, you know, we'll occasionally get opportunities at some of the majors, and we like it whenever that can happen. We really try to push their pieces whenever they're doing something that's interesting and timely, to get more voices on these various networks, and, you know, often in at odds with the people who are there. And that doesn't always, frankly, sit well with their audience. I have taken more than one call from an angry producer over the years, frustrated at who we have sent to them. And I've typically simply tried to point out to them, well, you know, I'm sorry they didn't have the tone you like, but, you know, I'm sorry, they're more they're representative of people too. And they don't, just because they don't sound like you want them to sound, doesn't mean that they don't speak for folks.
So Ben, let's kind of change things up a little, because you talked about how it started up and how things are going. So obviously what comes out of success is going to be criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I'm not talking about criticism over a specific content that's written, saying, hey, I this piece has this.
Why are
this,
you
and this.
Publishing Neil Doing?
Yeah, it becomes sniping, not so much criticism. So when you are faced with that kind of thing, and I'm seeing it, you know, so I see it all the time, especially on social media, people sniping at the Federalists. You know you've made it, Ben. The Federalist has a parody Twitter account that's called Federalist Pitches or something like that, you know.
Yeah,
so
can we talk about that for a minute? So this is, by my count, this is the third parody Twitter account we have actually had.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I remember
anti-federalist.
There was an anti-federalist one, and there's, what does a guy have to do to get a better class of parody? Because so I'm just telling you this honestly, we parody ourselves internally much, much better than people outside parody the Federalist. I mean, just to give you a small example of this, within our most recent March Madness league. I'm not going to get it exactly right, but Molly Hemingway's title for her team, which I believe came in third in the final March Madness rankings, which is much better than mine. I think I was either last or second to last, because I definitely did not have that final four right. Her team name was something like Tom Nichols spits on the corpses of opioid users. All right. That was the name of her team, you know, and this is something that we can do internally because, you know, we have respect for each other. And despite the fact that, you know, we may have differences of opinion about these things, you know, it's rather fun to mock each other over them. And so I look at these things and it's like, you could do a much better job of parodying us. I mean, come on, this is, there's all sorts of hot takes here that you know, could actually be fun. But one of the ones that with the anti-federalists had, or that one of the other ones had, was just something along the lines of conservative women have better sex or something like that. And I wanted to say, we publish that article about every 3 weeks. That's not a parody.
Yeah, that's real. That's, yeah.
Yeah, we do that, you know, I mean, and factually, I think it's defensible. So anyway, I think when I look out at the criticism, and I do see a good bit of it, because a lot of it tends to be, they tend to tag me. I think that it comes from sort of two sources. One source doesn't bother me at all, which is there's a significant portion of the media, particularly socially liberal members of the media, who hate and loathe us. And they do so in part because a lot of our material is stuff that gets into their feed, because it's commentating on cultural issues and other stuff that they don't necessarily, that lends it to show up there. And so it shows up in their social media, retweeted or posted by someone who doesn't realize it's coming from a center-right or a conservative or limited government perspective, and they get offended and they get upset by it. And that, I would say, is the prevalent aspect of the criticism that we get. We get a lot more of that than we do from the right. More of late, I would say that we get a lot from the right, but it comes from a specific kind of view, which is one that I think is basically a view that says that, you know, that editorially was probably very much in the never Trump category when that was something that was more active, that is frustrated with what they view as being an editorial approach to covering the current president that is more forgiving. But I would actually argue that we've been fairly consistent in the sense that, you know, my attitude from even before Trump won the nomination was, I want you to ding him whenever he's wrong. I want to run a piece dinging him whenever he's wrong. And then I want a piece that either says that, well, maybe he could be right, or that defends him in a way on a point where we think that he really is right, which, you know, I think is basically par for the course of a week with Trump. He's going to do something dumb. He's going to do something that is unfairly criticized. And then he's going to do something that, you know, I think is dubious, is, you know, could go either way. And he does that on basically a daily, but at least a weekly basis. And what we've tried to do, you know, is basically to say, let's run pieces that criticize him when we think he makes bad decisions. Let's run pieces that support him or react to those other pieces, and let's have a debate about it because we think that debate's important. And, you know, the truth is we had senior contributors before the election whose endorsements we ran. We didn't endorse anybody, but whose endorsements we ran, who said they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, who said they were going to vote for Gary Johnson, and who said they were going to vote for Donald Trump. And they all had rationales for those things. We even had one, a very prominent piece that went around quite a bit about figuring out a way for Evan McMullen, God rest his soul, to make his way to the presidency. And I think that, you know, the point of a publication that is attempting to be a big tent publication for the right is to include all those voices. Now, what I don't want to include, and what I think, you know, ought not to be included, are voices that really don't belong on the right. And I think that would include people who, you know, really have no history of espousing conservative ideas of any kind. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why you see fewer of those voices kind of creeping into our publication that have creeped into other publications that are right of center. I think that if you have, though, you know, some clear conservative beliefs or libertarian beliefs, or frankly, even just, you know, mildly center right beliefs, I think that that gives you the ability to come into our audience and to say, you know, look, I believe these things, and I think this about, you know, the current president or what he's trying to do or what his policies are. You know, my own view is, you know, I signed on to the anti-Trump cover for National Review. I do not regret that. I think that he has pleasantly surprised me with some of his actions thus far, particularly his Supreme Court pick. I'm very concerned about other aspects of his agenda, particularly as it relates to domestic policy and frankly to security policy. I think this issue has not yet raised its head, but I think it's going to become an issue during his presidency. I have been very much skeptical of the power of people to invade Americans' privacy. The one irony of this current controversy about Russia and Carter Page and the intelligence community is that it may end up making him less of an authoritarian in that regard. But my concern has really been for the first time that Rand Paul and that Donald Trump have a disagreement, because I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be on Trump's side. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that is inevitably going to happen at some point. That's a long answer, but the way I would sort of frame it is, what we attempt to do is to have a balanced approach, to say there's a significant number of Americans, obviously, who think of themselves as center right, who voted for Donald Trump and who believe that what he's doing is essentially the right thing, who support him. And we want to make sure that we are giving voice to those ideas, at the same time that we are not, you know, shedding the fact that what he represents is really a bend away from the Buckley-esque, Reagan-esque conservatism that was in favor of free trade, that was in favor of a more global view of the American responsibility, and that had a view of American exceptionalism that I think is at odds with the American first talk that he had. But I also don't think that we should demagogue what he represents or what he represents to the people who supported him. I think instead we should have a debate about it, because I think that's going to be important beyond him, even to see what comes next for America's conservative, libertarian, and limited government constituency. And that's something that I think is very important for the future.
Again, I wonder if you're giving the internet too much credit, Ben. Sticking with the theme of criticism, one more quick question about that, and it's a little bit different vein. Could you tell us what the most helpful criticism you've ever received was, whether it was specifically related to the Federalist and what's going on there, or just, you know, something that you got from a mentor, and maybe share that?
That's a good question. You'll have to edit out this pause. So there's a piece of advice. There's a piece of advice, and then there's its application. I was homeschooled And when I was growing up, what that allowed me to do was to intern at places in Washington much earlier than other people. And so I actually started my first internship at Human Events when I was 15 years old. And I worked for John Gizzi, who is now more famous as an internet meme for lifting his eyebrows and having his glasses fall down on his nose in the White House briefing room. John is a tall, sort of gubrious figure. He's very funny, and he knows a lot about a lot of things. And one of the things that he said to me when I was quite young, I think I was 16 actually, because I interned for him a couple of years in a row. And he said, one of the things that you have to do is just be cognizant of the fact that sometimes you're going to think that you've hit a wall when it comes to writing. But that's a myth. There is no wall. There is no block. You have to write your way through the block. And he said that as someone who basically was used to writing on the pace of a newspaper man, who had come up, having to turn in copy on this sort of regular basis. And it doesn't matter whether you have something to write about or not. And that really didn't click with me, I would say, until more than a decade later when I started writing The Transom, because one of the reasons I wrote The Transom, or the reason I really started it, is I just got fed up with these morning emails that had so little information in them and didn't really give you a full picture of what was going on or were very insidery. I opened up an edition of Mike Allen's, Politico morning email, and it's just all these birthdays of people who I didn't know. And I just was like, this doesn't help me at all. And so I just started writing something that was basically the way that I approached the internet every morning, which was just trying to find all these different things to read and to consume to prepare myself for the day. And I think what that really taught me was that the best way to get around the accusation that you don't have anything to say, or that you are, someone who, is getting what you have by dint of, luck or being good at TV or something like that, is to just work very, very hard and to basically get up every morning and try to write and do it even when you're not good at it. And recently, Peggy Noonan came out with a book that was a collection of her columns. And there was a passage in it that I posted just recently on Twitter, just because it was right after she won this Pulitzer for commentary this year. And it was a piece that she had written ages and ages ago about Tennessee Williams, about how Tennessee Williams kind of lost his touch, became uncool, was no longer someone who was viewed as being in the know or hip or someone that anybody artistic needed to pay attention to. And yet he would still get up and he would write every day, every day. And I think that that's something that is, it's not just about skill. It's about having that workmanlike approach to what you do. And if I could compare it to something, it would be, this was the same reason why, Winston Churchill was as accomplished as he was when it came to writing, was because he didn't stop. He just kept going, and he had assistance and he had help, but he just kept going at it. And not every word that he wrote is golden. A lot of them are, but he wrote a lot along the way. And so did G.K. Chesterton. And, frankly, I think, just about anybody who came from that old school approach that says, this is my job is to get up and do this, and I'm going to do it even if I don't like it. And I think that that's something that we need more of when it comes to writers today. Mm. There's too much of an attitude on their part of waiting for inspiration as opposed to pursuing something good and finding along the way that they are inspired, or that there's some aspect that they haven't figured out until they start to put those words down on the page.
That's great. That's a great point.
It is. All right, Ben. So let's ask one more question here before we wrap up. What has been your proudest moment since you started The Federalist? Besides Neil Dewing writing for you.
Wow. gosh, that's a close
There are
one.
So many.
There are so many. You know, I mean, I'm very glad that we published Tom Nichols' Death of Expertise. That is now a book that is out.
God, that is so huge right now.
Yep.
Yeah, he is a Hansel. And then I would say that I'm proud that we've stuck to our guns on the issue of transgender fights within the culture war, despite significant pressure from a lot of corners to not do that, particularly advertisers and the like. That's a significant problem for them. But I think that if I had a proudest moment, in all honesty, it has to be that Sean Davis made Neil deGrasse Tyson's life hell for about a week. and he did it through the most dogged investigation of the fact that Tyson had fraudulently used all these fake internet quotes to make this PowerPoint and made this claim about George W. Bush that was thoroughly false, and his remarks about Islam and about Christianity that he had invented whole cloth, to the point that Tyson eventually caved and apologizes in this Facebook post and basically admits that, you know, oh well, you know, it's just a memory kind of thing. And it's kind of a specific thing, but to me what that has is it has all the elements of a specific aspect of what we do that I think makes us very great in the sense that or meaningful, I would say, in the sense that there's so many people out there that are in the capacity of I effing love science, you know, who repost all these dumb memes and things that are inaccurate and stupid commentary from people and pretend to be, oh, you know, we're all about science. And then someone comes along like Sean, who's just like a bulldog when he finds something and says, no, you invented this, and you invented this to slander someone, and you did it in a way that was, you know, particularly vile and cut against everything that he stood for, and eventually, you know, called him on it to the point that he had to admit it, where you know he had to admit that this was wrong. There was one other thing that I could say that not necessarily a moment of pride, but I think is a good example of what we try to do. There was one day last fall where I think I was on NPR in the morning. David Harsanyi was on something in the midday. Molly Hemingway was on CNN. One of us was on Fox. And then the Rock retweeted one of our articles. and so if you're capable of like hitting the trifecta of networks, you know, hitting NPR, having The Rock retweet one of your stories, like that's good. That's basically, it's injecting all of these things into the media conversation that might not have been there otherwise. And I think that that's, you know, at the end of the day, what we're really trying to do is to question what the dominant thought process is on a lot of these things and to say, you know, maybe think a little bit differently about the way that you're viewing the world or thinking or drawing conclusions from what you say. Maybe consider the alternative view. Maybe consider something else.
All right. That's great, Ben.
That's great.
That's great.
Appreciate it. Hey, I got something to tell you, and this may interest you or may not. I don't know. I'm a late bloomer in the writing world. You know, I'm somebody who's, you know, I'm turning 47 this year, and I just...
Oh, congratulations. You look great for your age.
Thank you.
I thought you were 10 years younger.
Okay. Well, I just started writing full-time last fall. Left, you know, the safety and security of a Fortune 35 company to enter the world of freelance writing. So there's a little bit of craziness that goes along with that. But in 2014, I was published and paid for the first time in The Federalist. That was the first time I got paid for something, and that was an article I'd done about Mozilla and Brendan Eich.
Conservatives
were taking the wrong fight. They were doing the whole "let's boycott Mozilla" instead of going after the laws that allow a person's identity to be revealed just because they donate to a particular cause or something like that. So,
well, I'm glad we gave you your first beer money, and I hope it sent you on a path toward increased writing in this regard.
Yeah,
and,
well, Yeah, it was one of those things when we started Pocketful of Liberty, and I told Neil, I told everybody, it's like, well, I have no idea what's going to happen with this. And I said, if you guys wind up getting like paying gigs out of this somehow, I said, then I'll consider the site a success. Forget about traffic or anything like that. I said, if people can go on and do something else, then I'll be happy. And so, you know, even though you were pilfering my writers like Neil and Amy and everything like that, I was thrilled that they were going out and their work was reaching a bigger audience.
Well, good. And I'm glad and thank you. And do it not so much as pilfering as they're being marketed.
No, it was funny because you were like, well, come on, Jay, I got that right from the free beacon that right for me. I think you thought at first maybe I was a little put off by it, but I really wasn't. And I thought it was great. And I thought I was very happy for them. And I'm glad it's worked out well.
Well, good.
I'm putting aside all, you know, pretentiousness here, and I'm just saying I think you guys do a terrific job continued success. I think it's great.
Well, thank you. I truly appreciate it. And honestly, you know, the thing that I feel like, you know, with all of these endeavors is my real goal is to see all of these voices succeed. And, you know, my hope is that they succeed within us. But if they succeed elsewhere, you know, that's also fine too, in the sense that, you know, you want to elevate and refine and get to a point where you're having even more of an impact on the culture, on the conversation, and offering, you know, an alternative view to what the mainstream is ever going to promote. But that's fine. You can eventually get to a point where if you beat down their doors enough, if you have enough smart material, if you make enough people laugh, then you can get into that room too. And then once you get in there, it's hard to get you out because then you've proven that you're good at it and you belong there.
Yeah, certainly is true. Okay, we have one last bit of business.
Indeed.
You've been on the show before.
We only had one more question. We lied.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, right.
Well, this is a question of vital cultural importance and one I think the Federalist ought to cover. Perhaps you could even take it on as a hot take for the Federalist. Jay and I disagree rather strenuously on this matter, and we hope that our guests might resolve it for us. The question, sir, is the television show Seinfeld overrated?
No, I don't believe that the show Seinfeld is overrated. I don't. And I believe that mostly because I recently rediscovered the fact that Hulu allows you to stream like basically the entirety of Seinfeld, and
yes.
I had not realized that for some reason.
Oh, okay.
And what that allows you to do is to go back and to, you know, see all these episodes that you recall. And I would just say that compared to other sitcoms, I would argue that Seinfeld stands up as for the most part, timeless in a number of regards. It does not have the various weaknesses of a lot of other sitcoms that were made in the 90s and that seem very 90s in their references and what they're pointing out. It's something that stands up a lot better than that. And I will just say that my brother is more the Seinfeld aficionado than I am. He, when we got one of those trivia games about the show, he knew the answers to everything. But I don't think that it's overrated. The way I would just put it is this. I compare it to, apples to apples. So if you're looking at Cheers, you're looking at Frasier, you're looking at Friends, you're looking at, Home Improvement, you're looking at, and Everybody Loves Raymond or something like that. I would put Seinfeld at the top of these sitcom lists just because I think it stands up so much better than the rest of them as being uniquely timeless in a lot of respects, and that would be the case that I make.
We're going to need to have Sonny Bunch on this program, Jay, because I have a feeling Sonny Bunch might agree with me.
Yes, I think Sonny Bunch will almost certainly agree with
you. Seinfeld
you.
Is overrated.
You know what? But Sonny Bunch will probably end up making the case for The Big Bang Theory as the ultimate sitcom, or perhaps How I Met Your Mother.
And Big Bang Theory. Big Bang Theory was terrific for the first three seasons, and then.
What is your favorite sitcom, Neil?
I don't watch television.
Hogan's Heroes or something.
No. My favorite sitcom is probably something like Game of Thrones or The Leftovers or something like that. I find those pretty funny.
not The Dick Van Dyke Show? I'm sorry. Yeah. The Dick Van Dyke Show, I was going to say, it holds up pretty dang well.
It does.
There's hold some stuff up, in there. And right? I have a weakness for Dick Van Dyke, I must say.
Yep. So.
Not going to lie.
And oh man! Oh, all right, yes, Ben, thanks so much for being on. We appreciate it. Always appreciate you having you on here.
Happy to join you both.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully we'll have you back. We won't tell anybody the topic, but we did kind of talk about one other way a topic that we discussed. So I think we'll have you back to do that. And
yes,
and people will enjoy it.
I guarantee it. I guarantee it.
All right, Ben Domenech of the Federalist, everyone, and Neil. Thank you. As always, hope you enjoyed your bullet bourbon, which I'm sure you did. Right?
Too much.
Okay. There you go. All right. Jay Caruso for Neil Doing. Thank you for listening, everyone. Remember, go out to iTunes, leave us a review, leave us a star rating. We love it. And we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.